Hello, and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the February 14th to February 20th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration of a young person wearing a hooded sweatshirt looking into a screen in a dark room. On the front of the hoodie is an image of an older person, presumably a parent. The face on the shirt clearly seems to be appalled by whatever is on the screen, or any screen. The headline, Why Social Media Bans Won't Work. The cover leader, Let Them Scroll. Don't ban teenagers from social media. Restrictions would do more harm than good. Then, five additional leader articles in this program. First, Revitalizing Japan. The world's most powerful woman. Japan's prime minister has earned a once-in-a-generation chance to remake her country. Will she seize it? Then, 1.4 million deadly sins. The Epstein files tell a story of justice denied. Prosecutors have moved far too slowly. Then, the parable of Brazil. The rich world should beware Brazilification. When governments are indebted, high interest rates wreak havoc. Then, the travails of amateur choirs. The world lacks tenor singers. Or does it? A voice that is made, not found. And then finally, Britain in crisis. Britain's predicament will get worse before it gets better. With Sir Keir Starmer weakened, the government will drift left. Then, we'll have the first chapter in the America at 250 series. Enlightenment Ideals Meet American Reality, 1776 to the 1820s. So, that is our lineup. Let's go back to the top for the cover leader. Let Them Scroll. Don't ban teenagers from social media. Restrictions would do more harm than good. People don't agree on much these days, but one thing brings them together, whatever their politics. The idea that because social media harm children and teenagers, they should be banned from using them. In December, Australia stopped under-16s from having accounts on platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. A dozen countries, including Britain and Spain, are now toying with the idea. So are legislators in many American states. More than 70% of Britons support kicking under-16s off such sites, as do two-thirds of Americans. The problem is, bans will do more harm than good. The proposals arise from an understandable desire to keep youngsters safe and healthy. Parents have been shaken by tragedies in which social media have played a role, of children being tricked into sharing explicit pictures of themselves, or taking their own lives after algorithms shoveled them content about self-harm. Along with those shocking cases comes a second, more general worry, that social media might be damaging children as a group, making them reserved, lonely, and anxious. People are desperate to understand why today's youngsters seem unhappier than the generations that came before. Even parents who are confident they can keep their children from serious harm fret that their offspring are wasting hours scrolling through mindless memes. They would like to stop them, but fear that their kids will suffer if they are the only members of their class not on the apps. Blanket bans appear to offer an easy answer, and politicians are only too happy to seize on a measure that, for once, pleases voters from all parties. Yet policymakers should reconsider. The question of whether social media are causing mass harm is far from settled. Growing evidence suggests they are bad for at least some children, but the claim that social media causes great damage to the mental health of young people as a whole has only limited evidence. And even if you wanted to ban social media as a precaution, pending conclusive findings, such measures threaten to be counterproductive. One problem is that enforcing bans is hard. Teenagers in Australia are finding ingenious ways to get around them by scrunching up their faces to look older. Defining social media is hard, too. Australia has not banned young teenagers from messaging apps such as WhatsApp or from multi-layer online games, because that would have seemed too draconian. Scourges such as cyberbullying will doubtless continue on these. Kids barred from mainstream sites could flock to obscure ones and fall victim to predators there. Children who evade the blocks may be less likely to tell adults if they find something horrid, for fear of being told off. Higher age limits may just delay problems until youngsters are 16, when they will suddenly gain full access to social sites that they do not have much experience of using. And all the while, higher age limits for social media may provide a false sense of security. It is for all these reasons that bans are often opposed by child protection groups. Moreover, the proponents of bans ignore how they would deprive children of the benefits of social media. They are a blessing to children who feel isolated, perhaps because of their location, their sexuality, or because their brains work differently from those of others. Social media can broaden young minds, giving children from all backgrounds a window into fresh places and people. Like it or not, social sites are now one of the main ways children obtain information, as well as misinformation, about current affairs. It used to be easy for youngsters to pick up their parents' printed newspapers. They sat through news bulletins aired before or after their favorite shows. Those days are no more. Teenagers who are turfed off TikTok will not instantly begin climbing trees or poring over books. Many will slump for longer in front of games consoles and streaming devices. One reason they spend so many hours online is that parents long ago stopped letting them hang around outside with friends. Having chased them indoors, adults should now think twice about placing further prohibitions on their free time. What to do? Rather than raise age limits, regulators should redouble efforts to make social sites more suitable for teens. Ideally, they would force web firms to cough up more data on how teenagers use their products, the better to help researchers measure harms and come up with ways to prevent them. They should tell tech giants to rethink features that are keeping kids online longer than is healthy, such as interfaces that permit endless scrolling and videos that play without prompting. They should demand sterner moderation of the content being served up to young users. This may require greater efforts to verify the age of social media users in order to work out which ones must surf with guardrails and which are adults who may go without. Some observers find these ideas laughable. One reason people demand higher age limits is that they believe social apps cannot be made safer. That ignores the direction of travel. America is gearing up for a series of blockbuster trials, years in the making, that will finally give people who say they were harmed by sites as children a chance to make their case in court. The European Union has just issued a preliminary ruling that features of TikTok's design are, quote, addictive, and threatened fines if it doesn't change. Lately, many of the big social apps have been cajoled into creating, quote, teen accounts that come with additional safeguards. These things will not solve every single worry, but all of them are progress of a sort. Politicians say their social media bans are the only responsible option. In fact, they look like a way of ducking the care children deserve. If regulators cannot find ways to tame social media, now over two decades old, what hope is there to let children use novel tools such as artificial intelligence? Youngsters have a right to share in new technologies. Adults must seek to make their time online as safe and as rewarding as possible. That was the cover leader. Let them scroll. Don't ban teenagers from social media. Restrictions would do more harm than good. And we'll move now to leader article number 2. Revitalizing Japan, the World's Most Powerful Woman. Japan's Prime Minister has earned a once-in-a-generation chance to remake her country. Will she seize it? The Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, has dominated Japanese politics since its founding in 1955, ruling with only two brief interruptions. Never has it won as decisively as it did in a snap election on February 8th, when it took almost 70% of the seats in Parliament's powerful lower house. Takaichi Sane, the triumphant prime minister, now has a historic chance to transform her country. She must not squander it. To live up to the expectations that her electoral gamble and huge victory have created, Ms. Takaichi needs to think bigger and broader. She cannot treat her time in office as routine, focused on short-term relief to ease the pain of today. She must take Japan's long-term demographic and economic challenges head-on. She should also recognize that her country has a crucial role to play as a stabilizing force in a turbulent world. And she must be a leader for all of Japan, not only for her right-wing loyalists. She must, in short, gamble all over again. She has the backing. Support for Ms. Takaichi came from across the country. The LDP secured 316 seats in the 465-seat lower house, up from 198, giving it a two-thirds supermajority, which will allow it to override an upper house it does not control. Ms. Takaichi tapped into Japanese voters' desires for both security and change. She offered hard-nosed realism for a hard-edged era. She also personifies a break with the old guard. She is the plain-speaking child of a middle-class family, not the buttoned-up scion of a political dynasty, like many of her predecessors. And she is a woman, the first to lead Democratic Japan. A historic election unlocks historic opportunities, if Ms. Takaichi is bold enough to seize them. Most critically, she is well-placed to accelerate the transformation of Japan's defenses. The late Abe Shinzo, prime minister from 2012 to 2020, began beefing up the armed forces in response to China's assertiveness and America's unreliability. But the world has changed faster than Japan. Ms. Takaichi has already brought forward to the current fiscal year a planned increase in defense spending to 2% of GDP, originally planned for 2027. But it is still not enough. Anyway, simply boosting budgets is only part of it. Japan needs a wholesale reckoning with the new world disorder. The Prime Minister's willingness to break taboos, including talking about nuclear weapons, is healthy. She has the right ideas when it comes to unshackling the defense industry, encouraging defense innovation, and enhancing the country's intelligence capabilities. This will require enterprising diplomacy. Like American allies elsewhere, Japan has been unsettled by Donald Trump's return to the presidency. But even more than the members of NATO, Japan cannot afford to alienate America. It is surrounded by nuclear-armed adversaries in China, Russia, and North Korea, and for the moment, it relies on America's nuclear umbrella. Ms. Takaichi has done an admirable job of staying on Mr. Trump's good side. He even endorsed her before the vote. Yet even as Japan works with America, it should not hesitate to also work around America, as Abe did when he saved the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, a free trade deal, after Mr. Trump abandoned it during his first term. That did not preclude Abe from having a warm relationship with Mr. Trump. This time, Japan should spearhead efforts to link the CPTPP and the European Union, which would create a trade bloc covering over 30% of global output. Japan will need to demonstrate this global leadership at a time when its domestic resources are strained. A shrinking, aging population is the main drain on Japan's growth. As many other countries are learning, there are no easy solutions. Families are not a production line that can easily be speeded up. Instead, demographic change, like climate change, requires constant adaptation. The thumping election victory gives Ms. Taikaichi the space to make hard choices others have so far ducked. She should focus on unleashing the power of the people Japan has and on making it more welcoming to newcomers. The Social Security system needs urgent reforms. Firms should shift from rigid seniority-based lifetime employment practices to more flexible job-based systems. Patriarchal family law and tax structures that discourage marriage and keep women in low-paid work need to go. Japan should attract migrants, not demonize them. And as demands for spending on defense and welfare rise, Japan will have to reassure markets it can fund the programs it needs. Now might be an opportune time to gradually take profits on overseas assets in order to help reduce the gross debt. Is Ms. Taikaichi up to the task? Having taken office in October, she is untested. She could misinterpret broad support as a license to pursue her narrow ideological aims. An ardent nationalist, she might visit the Yasukuni Shrine, which honors Japan's war dead, including its imperial leaders, some of whom were war criminals. That would inflame relations with China and wreck Japan's fragile rapprochement with South Korea, essential to countering China's rise. An arch social conservative, she could fan anti-foreigner sentiment, repelling the migrants Japan needs to help offset its shrinking population and the tourists who boost its economy. A fiscal dove, Ms. Taikaichi could pursue a big spending agenda that fuels inflation and panics bondholders. One test will be a populist campaign promise to suspend an 8% sales tax on food for 2 years, all without issuing new debt. Although voters may have believed in such magical thinking, markets know better. She will need to find a way to pay for the giveaway or scrap it. The Prime Minister's inbox is daunting. No wonder Japanese are anxious. Ms. Taikaichi asked voters if they wanted her to lead them through these tumultuous times. The answer was a resounding yes. But if she wastes her mandate on symbolism and populism, more corrosive alternatives will flourish, and Japan will not soon give another leader such a huge chance. That was Leader Article Number 2, Revitalizing Japan, the World's Most Powerful Woman. Japan's Prime Minister has earned a once-in-a-generation chance to remake her country. Will she seize it? We turn now to Leader Article Number 3, 1.4 Million Deadly Sins. The Epstein files tell a story of justice denied. Prosecutors have moved far too slowly. No wonder that the life and mysterious death of Jeffrey Epstein fuel a nihilistic and conspiratorial view that all the elites are rotten. In what is supposed to be a meritocracy, too many of the best and the brightest turn out to be motivated by flattery, vanity, cupidity, cruelty, and lechery. An unknown number of powerful men, and some women, trafficked and abused a much larger number of vulnerable women and girls. Those victims urgently need justice. Epstein, a financier, fixer, rapist, and pedophile, died in a Manhattan prison cell in 2019. Under popular and congressional pressure, the Department of Justice, or DOJ, released over 3 million pages of documents on January 30th, too many for anyone to have read. This week, volunteer software engineers converted them into a format that could be analyzed. The Economist has examined this archive. Epstein appears to have been careful about mixing his prolific sexual abuse with his broad network of influence peddling. We scored each of the 1.4 million emails by how relevant it was to his crimes. Around 1,500 threads belong to the most severe category, where, for instance, a correspondent made light of abusing Epstein's, quote, littlest girl. Nearly 60% of the emails were to people Epstein paid to make his life easier. Some handled the bureaucratic complications from his record as a sex offender. Others scrubbed the web of references to his plea bargain over child prostitution and soliciting in 2008. Because of this concealment, a number of Epstein's social contacts who today protest that they did not grasp the extent of his crimes may be telling the truth. The rest of the emails depict an astonishing network of influence and favor trading. Of the messages to his 500 main correspondents, excluding his own staff and business partners, almost 20% involve financiers, 10% scientists or doctors, 8% media, entertainment, and public relations, and 6% each lawyers, politicians, academics, and business people. Although some of his contacts were from countries like Britain and Norway, the vast majority were American. In the worst cases, some members of those networks appear to be implicated in sex trafficking. Others, such as the physicist Lawrence Krauss, may not be criminals, but deserve opprobrium for their moral failure. Still others, like the Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, have lied about relatively minor dealings with Epstein. Even if no more damning evidence turns up, they should answer for their dishonesty. Some, such as author J.K. Rowling, have been pilloried despite the evidence being that the contact was one-sided and came from him. The files tend to mash these different categories together. That is partly because when Epstein makes allegations, it is hard to know if he is lying. It is also because the DOJ's haphazard redactions have shielded criminal abusers, revealed those who briefly came into Epstein's orbit, and too often exposed the identity of victims. Redactions are essential to protect innocent victims, but blacked-out faces and names of women and girls inadvertently exacerbate how these vast files, detailing the routine abuse of over 1,000 victims, tend to make the story all about the men. Female bodies are turned into objects in what is a tragic echo of Epstein's own abuses. The duty to those women and girls is to bring their abusers to justice without delay. It is reprehensible, and indeed hard to understand, why the DOJ has made so little progress filing charges over the past 7 years. The delay is as baffling as the leniency of Epstein's original plea bargain 18 years ago. That was Leader Article Number 3, 1.4 Million Deadly Sins. The Epstein files tell a story of justice denied. Prosecutors have moved far too slowly. And we'll move on now to Leader Article Number 4, The Parable of Brazil. The rich world should beware Brazilification. When governments are indebted, high interest rates wreak havoc. The world economy offers many cautionary tales. Argentina's inflation has shown the danger of treating a central bank like a cash machine. Italy's stagnation shows the downside of joining a currency union with high legacy debts. Britain has suffered from Brexit, which has thrown up barriers to trade with its closest neighbors. But the most timely warning for many of the world's big economies comes from Brazil. As we report, Brazil has decent economic growth, an independent central bank, and its primary budget, that is, excluding interest payments, is almost balanced. Its net debts, at 66% of GDP, are high by emerging market standards, but low by rich world ones. Brazil, however, has one big problem. Its government must pay sky-high interest rates to service its debts. Controlling inflation has required the central bank to set short-term rates at 15%. As a result, and despite being close to primary balance, the government will probably borrow about 8% of GDP a year to pay its interest bill. Closing the deficit through austerity is unlikely. President Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, who is campaigning for re-election in October, has loosened the purse strings. Unless interest rates fall a lot, public debt will surge. The fiscal plight of Brazil casts rich world budgets in sharp relief. You may think governments in wealthier places are fiscally squeezed, but America, Britain, France, and Italy still enjoy borrowing costs in the low to mid single digits. Their debts would stabilize if only they balanced their primary budgets or came close to it. By contrast, Brazil would probably need to run a primary surplus of around 5% to keep its debts stable if interest rates do not fall. Western policymakers should consider why interest rates are so high in Brazil. The answer lies in a combination of factors. Brazil's institutions, despite enjoying formal protections like central bank independence and the separation of powers, are wobbly and teetered during President Jair Bolsonaro's attempted coup in 2022. Inflation is on a shorter fuse, even after three decades of technocratic central banking, owing in part to a legacy of hyperinflation in the 1980s and early 1990s, and an economic crisis in the mid-2010s. Last, the long-term trajectory of the budget is dire. Brazil's government spends 10% of GDP on pensions. Without reforms, by 2050, it will spend more on pensions than richer, grayer countries. Yet pensions are protected in the Constitution, which, for example, requires that when the minimum wage rises, retired folk get more money too. The extraordinary hold of pensioners over the budget makes it hard to balance the books, and also crowds out other more worthwhile spending. The diagnosis should worry the rich world, which shows early symptoms of Brazilification. America's institutions are suffering. President Donald Trump has politicized the Justice Department, yearns to control the Federal Reserve, and muses about federalizing his country's elections. After the big price rises that followed the pandemic, and with geopolitics menacing supply chains, inflation is a greater risk than in recent decades, and spending on pensions and health care is growing as populations age. Pensions might not enjoy the same level of formal protection as in Brazil, but older voters like them. Just look at Britain's, quote, triple lock, which ensures that pensions outpace wage growth in the long term. If this pushes up interest rates, today's budget dilemmas could seem trivial. Many rich countries are straining to find an extra 1 or 2% of GDP for defense spending. Imagine if they had to find that twice over again for debt interest. It might seem painfully difficult in a populist world both to promise low inflation and to spend less on the elderly. But that is nothing compared with the agonizing choice that looms for Brazil, between deep austerity and a terrifying debt interest spiral. We just heard Leader Article number 4, The Parable of Brazil. The rich world should beware Brazilification. When governments are indebted, high interest rates wreak havoc. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program, featuring articles from the February 14th to February 20th edition of the magazine. And we turn now to Leader Article number 5, The Travails of Amateur Choirs. The world lacks tenor singers. Or does it? A voice that is made, not found. Vincerò, sang Andrea Bocelli on February 6th, as athletes carried the Olympic torch around the San Siro Stadium in Milan. It was a thrilling moment. The word in Nessun Dorma, from Puccini's opera Turandot, demands a sustained high B, a ringing, show-off note for a professional tenor singer. In the ordinary world, though, tenors are not proclaiming victory. A great many people sing in choirs. Germany, which created much of the world's best choral music and now collects excellent statistics, counts 45,000 groups. Not enough of those people are tenors. Music for mixed-sex adult choirs is normally arranged in four voice parts, from highest pitch to lowest, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. Many choirs could do with more basses, but they are painfully short of the voices just above that range. A bit more from the tenors, please, implore conductors in schools, halls, and churches across the singing world, and a bit less from the sopranos. Why the shortage exists is unclear. Perhaps men's voices have lowered as they have become taller. Perhaps they fear sounding unsexily shrill. Another possibility is that singing the tenor part is hard, both physically and musically. If singing abilities are declining in general, tenors would suffer first. Whatever the causes, the consequences are plain. Some of the classical choral repertoire has already become unsingable for many choirs. Do not attempt Fauré's Requiem, which demands that the tenors divide and sing two separate parts, unless you have a strong section. Other music sounds thin and lacking in the strange, slightly desperate note that tenors supply. Amateur choirs have tried charging tenors lower membership dues, or even paying them. For a fee, a semi-professional ringer or stiffener will briefly join the section to boost its sound. This works in a pinch, although it cuts against the collectivist culture of many choirs. In desperation, some groups plump for music that omits the tenor line and treats all men as mid-range baritones. The approach suits some kinds of music, such as gospel, better than others. But the danger is of a downward spiral, as choirs with few tenors pick music that does not require them, and the remaining tenors fade away. Although the voice is unlikely to vanish entirely, it could become unusual, a special sound for special occasions. Ideally, the stock of tenor singers would be larger, not merely allocated more efficiently. It would help in the long run if schools made singing more of a priority, especially among teenagers. Many boys stop singing after their voices break, not only because they struggle with a new instrument, but also because they are rudely thrown from singing the tune into singing harmony. In the short run, choirs that can afford it would do well to consult voice coaches. They might discover that some of the men who have assigned themselves to the bass section can sing tenor, as can some of the women who sit with the altos. Tenor voices are like gold, and not only because they are rare and valuable. They need to be dug out of people and worked on. Everyone should remember that choirs do not demand singers who sound like Mr. Bocelli. An ordinary tenor in a chorus is seldom, if ever, called upon to reach a high B or to sing with anything approaching his power. Of course, a tenor might briefly imagine that he or she sounds just like an Italian opera star when hitting a tricky entrance correctly or when, miracle of miracles, the rest of the section gets it right too. It is not the world's most harmful fantasy. That was Leader Article number 5, The Travails of Amateur Choirs. The World Lacks Tenor Singers. Or does it? A voice that is made, not found. And we'll move now to the 6th and final Leaders Section article in this issue, Britain in Crisis. Britain's predicament will get worse before it gets better. With Sir Keir Starmer weakened, the government will drift left. In Britain, political instability has become chronic. The story is grimly familiar. A once triumphant prime minister's poll ratings plummet, and Downing Street turns into a bunker. A distant scandal suddenly becomes existential, and the cabinet belatedly offers its support. A coup fizzles after an impassioned address to MPs in which the leader promises that everything will be different. But it isn't. The Prime Minister's authority is shot, and the government limps on. In a way, the humiliation of Sir Keir Starmer, Britain's fourth Prime Minister in 4 years, is greater than that of his Conservative predecessors. After a landslide win in 2024, he boasted of governing for a decade, but local elections in 12 weeks' time may finish him off. The revelation that Peter Mandelson, his former ambassador to America, was appointed despite Sir Keir knowing of the length of his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein has shattered the Prime Minister's image as dull but competent and incorruptible. The aides who ran his swaggering operation have resigned. The cabinet secretary is leaving. A Prime Minister who defined himself as a constraint on the left-leaning Parliamentary Labour Party now governs as its hostage. After the drama of the past week, it is tempting to think things can only get better. Labour's crisis, it might be hoped, will prove the catalytic moment Britain needs. Perhaps a brave young reformist will emerge from the ranks of Labour MPs and put the party's vast governing majority to work in tackling Britain's problems. Alas, the more likely path is drift. The Labour Party is preoccupied by self-preservation and traumatized by how quickly voters have soured. With or without Sir Keir, it will retreat to its soft left comfort zone and muddle along the path of electoral least resistance. Party unity will trump boldness. For Britain, things will get worse before they get better. The stasis in Downing Street contrasts with the urgency of the national situation. Problems ailing much of the rich world are found in abundance in Britain. Growth is not dreadful by European standards, but is too meager to give voters the living standards and public services they want. The cost of servicing Britain's debt as a share of GDP has risen this decade to its highest since the late 1980s. Rearmament, an aging population, and an unreformed welfare system are straining the public finances. Voters know it. The share who think the state needs to shrink is higher than at any point since 1983. A Declinist mood, redolent of Britain in the 1970s, hangs in the air. Sir Keir's election landslide was meant to escape this trap. Yet, without a plan or the political capital to get much done, he has failed. Labour's Safety First campaign promised small giveaways while ruling out big tax changes. Laws to empower trade unions and renationalize the railways were drawn up, but no intellectual spadework was done on reform to the civil service, regulated markets, public services, or welfare. Many of his MPs came to Parliament expecting the money to flow, just as it eventually did under Labour in the 1990s. Rather than confront them, Sir Keir nodded along, and when they revolted at cuts to welfare and pensioner benefits, he backed down. His caution in opposition was termed the Ming Vase strategy. As a project for government, it has proved a hollow vessel indeed. That is why a change of course now is so improbable. In an age of electoral fragmentation, when voters' loyalties to old parties have broken down, governing on a low vote share is a fact of life. Calling an election today would be likely to cause hundreds of Labour MPs their seats. Hence, the panic and timidity is likely to continue, whoever is in number 10. Powerful currents will pull Labour left. Sir Keir's boasts of having, quote, changed the party by purging the hard left under Jeremy Corbyn mask how far its center of gravity has shifted since the times of Sir Tony Blair. The leadership contenders most popular in the party, Andy Burnham, Ed Miliband, and Angela Rayner, are all to the left of Sir Keir. So are the bulk of MPs, who came of age under the austerity of the 2010s. The Labour membership will pick the next leader. 89% of them think that taxes and spending should go up, a view shared by only one in five voters. And if Labour is to hold on to power and defeat the right-wing populists of Reform UK, it must attract voters who have defected to the populist left Green Party. Already, Sir Keir has declared that, quote, putting money in people's pockets, rather than economic growth, is his first priority. There may be greater skepticism of big tech. Palantir, a software firm, is the bogeyman du jour. The government may become more pro-European, which would be good, but only if accompanied by a hard-headed realism that leads to productive negotiations. The heaviest cost will be what is left undone. A mantra of, quote, unity and, quote, inclusion sounds benign, but makes for a lowest common denominator government in which everyone gets a veto. Welfare reform will be off the table. So will any overhaul of education or the civil service that irritates the unions. Planning, a bright spot, may sink back into its old ways because labor members like nature and dislike developers. Above all, chronic instability means ignoring the public finances. Labor MPs are wont to declare that they didn't get into politics to impose cuts on their voters. A prime minister who clings on to power by handing out treats is not running a government, but an ice cream van. Bond investors may lose patience. Perhaps the coming years will breed a generation of labor modernizers clear-eyed about Britain's problems. In the meantime, voters will have to look elsewhere for renewal. Reform, which leads the polls, is disrupting the political order, but offers little new thinking, beyond a mix of stale anti-immigration rhetoric and vague promises to slash the bits of the state its voters don't use. Perhaps it will fall to the Conservatives, under Kemi Badenoch, to provide intellectual and economic renewal from the right. She is beginning to find her feet. Britons know their country needs to change, and financial markets may force change. Therein lies a political opportunity. That was the sixth and final Leader article in this issue, Britain in Crisis. Britain's predicament will get worse before it gets better. With Sir Keir Starmer weakened, the government will drift left. And we'll move now to Chapter 1 of the America at 250 series, which was introduced in a Leader article a few weeks back. The title of this chapter is Enlightenment Ideals Meet American Reality, 1776 to the 1820s. The Breakup, 1776. 80 years ago, on July 4, 1776, the Second Congressional Congress in Philadelphia approved the Declaration of Independence. Signing would take weeks. This was before email. The United States of America, as the troublemakers styled their new creation, had already been at war with Britain for more than a year. Good King George III was not the tyrant of American legend, but we grudgingly admit that his insistence on asserting authority and raising revenue in the colonies helped turn protest into revolution. The Declaration became America's first great statement of liberal principle, espousing those Enlightenment ideals of natural rights and government by consent. It proclaimed that, quote, all men are created equal, though many of its signatories owned slaves. With rare exceptions, white women and black people were excluded from voting, as were many poor white men. Indigenous nations were ignored or exploited. The world's first liberal republic was, in practice, a narrow aristocracy, without the noble titles. But, as George Washington said, the government's true character would only emerge with time. Revolution accomplished. Now what? 1787. Having won their little war, the founders convened a constitutional convention in Philadelphia to take on a new challenge, turning Enlightenment principles into an enduring political structure. Using a blueprint from James Madison, they eventually settled on a republican system with three branches of government, each checking and balancing the power of the others. The Constitution's framers also wrote in protections for slavery. Some Northern delegates who opposed the institution on principle nonetheless yielded to their Southern slaveholding colleagues for the sake of unity. In doing so, they ensured that slavery would endure for generations. An ideal that the Constitution's Northern and Southern framers could agree on was a national executive strong enough to be effective, but not so strong that it would descend into tyranny. This was the original No Kings movement, though the French Revolution would soon go a little harder on that point. So you're holding elections now? 1789. The first ballot for president was, like modern elections, conducted via the odd institution of the Electoral College, rather than by a direct popular vote. In virtually all other ways, it was unrecognizable to anyone following American politics today. There was no public campaign, not even a swift boat advertisement painting Washington's crossing of the Delaware in a nefarious light. There was no sweating the count on election night either. Having led the Continental Army to victory, Washington was a shoo-in for the presidency, even as he claimed not to want the job. He was selected on all 69 Electoral College ballots that were cast. John Adams, marked on 34 ballots, each elector could list two names, became vice president. Only one presidential election has been decided unanimously since, Washington's own re-election. 10 Things They Left Out, 1791. The Bill of Rights, ratified in 1791, transformed the Constitution from a merely Republican charter to a liberal one, enshrining freedoms of speech, religion, and due process, to name but a few. The author's vague language ensured that Americans, among them Supreme Court justices, would still be arguing about it 250 years later. Even the use of punctuation is the subject of intense legal debate. In the 21st century, the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Second Amendment, reached in part on its placement of commas, ensures that individual Americans, not just militias, have a constitutional right to own guns. The founders could scarcely have imagined AR-15s. Clash of the Founders, 1790s. By 1790, the founders were still arguing over how much power the central government should have. The Broadway musical Hamilton told the story through epic rap battles between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. The actual debates were not conducted in verse. Hamilton was a New Yorker, the first Treasury Secretary, and our kind of guy. He wanted a strong federal government that paid its debts. That's also very much our thing. Jefferson was a Virginian farmer, a slaveholder, and the first Secretary of State. He argued for states' rights, fearing that centralization would bring tyranny. Hamilton won, and thankfully that was the last time there was any disagreement about federal power in American history. How to Save a Republic, Jail Your Critics, 1798. An early reactionary moment in America arrived in 1798. Those excitable French were in the midst of a revolution. Tensions between France and America were high. President John Adams's Federal Party viewed its critics at home, namely pro-French Jeffersonians, as potential traitors. With Adams's support, Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, four laws giving the president power to deport, quote, dangerous foreigners, and making it a crime to publish, quote, false, scandalous, and malicious writing about the government. They were used to silence opposition journalists and pamphleteers. One tell that they were undemocratic and illiberal was that Congress set two of the laws to expire on Adams's last day as president in March 1801. The controversy helped Jefferson win the race to succeed Adams as president and hastened the decline of the Federalist Party. The Original Dealmaker-in-Chief, 1803. Donald Trump could learn a thing or two from Jefferson. While today's president muses about acquiring Greenland, Jefferson doubled the size of America in a single transaction. In 1803, after negotiations with Napoleon Bonaparte, he purchased the vast Louisiana Territory from France for $15 million, $314 million in today's dollars. The tract of land stretched from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains and encompassed 828,000 square miles, or more than 20% of modern America. The Louisiana Purchase secured land for the yeoman farmers, whom Jefferson considered the backbone of the country. But he also worried that the deal might be unconstitutional. He himself had long argued that the federal government had no power not explicitly granted by the Constitution, and the charter said nothing about buying half a continent. The deal was made using executive power, on Hamiltonian terms. That time we burned down your White House, 1812 to 1815. Talk about Trumpian. Having declared war on Britain in 1812, America invaded Canada, expecting to be greeted as liberators from British oppression. They were not. The war itself had been triggered by Britain's repeated interference in American affairs. On the Western Front, aiding Native Americans' resistance to U.S. territorial expansion. On the Eastern Front, interdicting American ships and pressing sailors into the Royal Navy to fight in the Napoleonic Wars. Britain notoriously set fire to the White House, but America in many respects won the War of 1812, as the British thereafter left the North American mainland largely to American ambitions. Native Americans were doomed to military subjugation. The war also made a national hero and future presidential contender of Andrew Jackson, who won the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. The Stain of Slavery, 1619 to 1865. At the time of America's founding, an estimated 500,000 of the roughly 2.5 million people living in the 13 colonies were enslaved, about one in five Americans. By 1800, that number had risen to nearly 900,000. In the South, just before the Civil War, enslaved people made up more than one-third of the population. Slavery, as much as freedom, would shape America's first century. How did the country's founders, so enamored of the ideal of, quote, liberty, justify it? Often by applying self-serving, twisted logic to liberal principles. Some invoked the idea that property rights were essential to freedom, that is, the freedom of slave owners to keep slaves as property. Others argued that slavery was a temporary evil worth tolerating for the sake of keeping a young country together. Still others claimed that slavery was an economic engine that the country could not do without. Many simply believed all men were not created equal, despite their soaring revolutionary rhetoric to the contrary. Secrets of the Ex-President Group Chat Revealed, 1820. Jefferson's record on slavery was particularly troubling. Though he professed opposition in principle, he fathered several children with one of his own slaves, Sally Hemings. He also favored extending slavery into new Western states, arguing, under his peculiar theory of diffusion, that dispersing slaves would reduce their concentration and make emancipation less frightening to slaveholders. Jefferson summed up these anxieties in a letter to his frequent late-in-life pen pal, John Adams, asking rhetorically, quote, "Are our slaves to be presented with freedom and a dagger?" Adams replied that slavery had been a, quote, "black cloud," hanging over the country for half a century. In 1820, the Missouri Compromise drew a line across the map, with slavery permitted below and banned above. The compromise postponed the reckoning. Slavery would endure for nearly another half century. That was Chapter 1 of the special series America at 250, Enlightenment Ideals Meet American Reality. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the February 14th to February 20th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veach, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ On Demand.